the best salesperson in the world, if they're not confident that the thing they're selling is going to get the outcome for the customer, they will not be nearly as performant as they can be when they know that that customer is in the right place at the right time, buying the right thing for their problems.
I'm Johnny Page. I'm Matt Verlet, and this is the SaaS Academy Podcast.
All right, here we are, round two of the SaaS Academy mailroom. So we're going into our coaching communities, our Facebook groups. We're snagging some of the coolest questions that people are asking. Of course, they get answered in there, but we're also answering them in here so Johnny and I can riff on them here on the podcast in public for all of you guys. What's going on, Johnny Page? How you doing, man?
I'm doing amazing. I'm excited to be going back into the mailroom. We got some good questions teed up here. Let's do it.
All right. Setting the table from Michael. His question, he's referring to a framework we have in the Academy called the Team Offsite Planner, right? Where we walk people through how to do an epic offsite for their team. But his question, when you're running an annual planning, do you invite every single person in the whole company or just the team leaders? So that's the question on the table. Johnny, what are your thoughts, man?
Dude, I like running annual planning in a couple of different stages. And you are our COO, so correct me. I'll tell you what I like, and then you can tell the version that we do. And there's a lot of overlap there. But there,
it's basically a live performance evaluation is what you're telling me. That's cool.
Yeah. How well can Johnny recite our operating cadence?
Oh, I thought it was for me. You're good.
Oh, yeah. No. I'm sure you'll recite it and probably bring out some spreadsheets and some software along with it.
See how it goes.
But man, I like doing one is capturing, like let's have a meeting probably with our team leads to say, hey, what are the biggest challenges and opportunities? Let's unpack together where we feel like, what are we doing well? What would you like to be doing moving forward? And then zero in on a couple of those bigger rocks or potentials. But I like there being some time in between when we survey and consider versus when we decide. So I'd go just team leads. Hey, who's, what are the biggest challenges and opportunities? Take some time and then come back and then lock in those rocks. And then on a third meeting, share with the team, this is where we're going. So the answer is both, but there's a certain cadence to it. Matt, you've done an incredible job at dialing this in for us. So what are your suggestions for Michael?
I think there's one piece of context I don't have to answer this well, so I'll answer it both ways. It's team size, right? I think that's the big one because I use the kitchen table rule, right? Like if you can fit at a kitchen table, like you might have like team leads, but you have a small team, like get together and go figure it out. One meeting, one call, hash it out, right? So I think that when you actually have multiple team leaders supervising teams, obviously like when you outgrow the kitchen table, in my opinion, you also outgrow the ability to run like a one and done planning process. And so when it comes to annual planning, that's when I would do exactly what you said, right? And so I think that like for us, we set goals at the executive level, then we set initiatives. And when I say goals, I'm like revenue and profit. And that's pretty much it, aside from like major strategic annual initiatives. That's the only thing that we really do top down. Then the team leaders make the plans in their departmentals, right? Because if you either build the fight or you plan the fight or you fight the plan, right? So like they have to set their goals and their plans in support of the goal that we come up with. And then they have meetings with their teams to like do the nuts and bolts of how we actually get the plan done. So it's kind of three stages there, the way we run it now. But that would be crazy overbuilding if you have a 6-person team or an 8-person team, right? So if you can fit in the kitchen, do one meeting, hash it out, make a plan, and get after it. It doesn't need to be overbuilt until it needs to be, So I think that's kind of where I'm at with it.
Yeah. Great question, Michael. Have fun in that annual planning.
Love it. All right. Next up from Tommy. Oh, this is right in your wheelhouse, Johnny. I love this question. What is the process to create a really strong customer case study? Tommy says he's got info on the customer. He's got info on like how they've successfully used the software to grow their revenue, et cetera, et cetera. But he wants to make sure that like the juice is worth the squeeze, right? If he's putting an effort to create a testimonial or case study, like how do you use it? So it's like a two-parter. What's the process to create it? And then how do you use it in ways that make that effort worth it? So you got a deep CS background, man. I'm stoked to hear your thoughts on this one.
Yeah, man, I love this. In fact, I love customer success as a growth strategy. So if all you did was give me 100 customers on a platform, I could, without a sales team and a marketing team, I could grow that thing. Now, certainly faster if we do it with a, you know, sales and a marketing team and a winning product, but very hard to do it the other way around. So I'm going to answer your question at face value. What do you do to get a great case study? But I'm going to talk you through the system that I prefer that extracts a ton of value and evidence of your product, you know, winning for your customers, which is what I think you're really asking. So I like a case study. It can be, look, the more authentic and organic that it is, the more believable it is. So these high production case studies where there's someone sitting in a nice, you know, office chair in front of a fern with the lighting all perfect, pretty boring, right? Like I like, dude, some of my favorite testimonials, like, hey, ask your client to pick up their phone in a vertical video and a, you know, audio doesn't have to be great. And you answer four questions. The first question is, what were you doing before you used it? What problems were coming up in the business? Why did you choose us? You know, what made you choose it? What was life like after? What are the biggest benefits? And then what metrics can you point to that show that it's done its job? Like, we want to try to get some real numbers behind the impact of the of implementing the product. So just ask those four questions to get a great case study. And then I would engineer more for volume of case studies than getting one single one really right with high production value. So the method I use for this, in fact, we teach this in the academy, it's called the customer value extractor, is we want to look for any time there's a bright spot in the client journey. So maybe they've reached a point of adoption, they've got an early win in your product. That's a great time to, it's a, you know, early on in the relationship, let's ask for something that's really easy to do. Send them to G2 Crowd or Capterra and ask them for a review. It could take less than 5 minutes, but we pair the bright spot in the customer journey with an ask. Then maybe, you know, a couple months go by, we have another win. Customer tells us, hey, you know, maybe we've solved a support ticket really quickly and they have, hey, thanks so much for being responsive. Now we can escalate the ask a little bit. Maybe we ask them for a testimonial. Hey, I'm going to send you four questions. Would you mind just firing up your camera, answering these? Or hey, can we jump on a Zoom call and answer these? But you essentially escalate your asks over time to get a volume of case studies and testimonials, and even this escalate to referrals. But I love pairing this with a bright spot in the client journey and just go for volume. Don't overthink it. Get a ton of them. You have 100 testimonials and thousands of reviews online. You're not going to be heard in four. Oh man, I wish this one was a little bit higher production, or I didn't ask that question just right. Like, yeah. Keep winning for your customers. Keep shining a light on them. Be consistent with the asks and you'll have a ton to work with.
Can I double click on the last part of Tommy's question real quick? Because I think it's really important. Like, when you have these fire testimonials, like, where are you repurposing them to get the ROI out of the effort it takes to create them?
What a bummer if you like create all the case studies and then don't know where to use
them. That's why I wanted to double click on it. Because like, I could see someone following your process and be like, cool, I got them. Now what do I do? Like, how are you using these things?
Yeah. So first off, I just publish it. All of them on our website. I just have a rolling feed for as long as you can scroll. You've got all the testimonies that someone can like can go through and click and watch. Separately, I would categorize them and arm your sales team with testimonials or case studies that directly address certain objections that come up in your sales process. So the reason why you ask, what were you doing before and why did you choose us, is in some parts, they're going to talk about the objections, and you can double click as you start to produce more of these, you'll go produce case studies that you know will help solve objections in your sales process. And you might say, hey, we get a pricing objection all the time. So we want to go capture a case study where someone says, hey, at first I was surprised by the cost. I couldn't imagine myself spending this amount on it, but after a lot of back and forth, you know, we decided to take the leap and I'm so glad we did because, and then you've asked in the testimonial, you've asked for the numbers that this impacted, and they're ideally speaking to some type of ROI. So you want to arm your sales team with, hey, these are the top 10 to 12 testimonials that we have that speak to and handle some objections, and we use them in the sales process. You can see them, think about if you have a content marketing approach, we can use them and pair with certain blogs or videos that we produce, pair our testimonials in that make the connection between, you know, the topic that we're teaching on and our product as a solution. So lots of places you can use them. The low hanging fruit is make sure you publish a ton of them on the website, and then, you know, you arm your sales team with where to use them in the sales process.
If the stuff that Johnny's been dropping in this episode is landing with you guys as much as it's been landing with me, like, do us both a favor. Just find the share button and share this thing out, you know, in a message or a social media post with something. Like, I'm spoiled. I get to work with Johnny every day. And, you know, he always drops these huge, like, knowledge bombs on me whenever we're working on a problem. But, man, he's been just on fire this episode. So if you want to share it out, that would be amazing. It would just help us grow so much. So hit the share button, share it with your friends. Appreciate you guys.
Next question from John. Oh, it's a nice nerdy one. I like it. How do you calculate LTV, lifetime value? Then how do you incorporate existing clients into the formula?
Yeah, I'm not going to attempt to do this one the justice that you can. Why don't you, you're the numbers guy, Matt, walk through your views. I think you've got an opinion on LTV, especially for early stage SaaS.
I got nothing. I got no shortage of opinions on everything. But I'm going to answer the question first about how you calculate it, and then let's talk about using it, right? So the way you calculate it, the first thing you need is your ARPU, or your average revenue per user, or average revenue per account, right? So essentially, you take your total MRR divided by the number of customers you got. So if you're doing $50,000 in monthly recurring revenue, got 100 customers, your average revenue per account is $500 a month, right? So super simple so far. So on average, every customer is worth $500 a month. Take that 500 and divide it by your monthly churn rate, right? So, you know, 500 divided by 4% or 0.04 would give you a $12,500 customer lifetime value. So that's how you calculate it. It inherently incorporates existing clients because just going from your existing client base, and that's how you calculate your average revenue per account. But the more interesting discussion, I think, is when do you use this and when do you not use this? In the context of B2B SaaS, which is the area that we play in, I can't really think of too many scenarios where your goal is to have a customer who sticks around for less than a year, right? Like, you know, half the people listening to this are doing annual contracts. The other half are definitely playing long-term games, you know, trying to retain people. And so the trap that I've seen, especially early stage SaaS, fall into, you know, you look at, you know, a lot of like the advice out there is like, you should have a certain ratio between your customer acquisition cost and your lifetime value. It'll be like 3-to-1, et cetera, et cetera. But when you don't have a long tail data set on your lifetime value, it will fluctuate wildly. And so, especially when you've got 30 customers, right? And you have, you'll say you lose three of them, that's a 10% monthly churn. Your average revenue per account, if you go from 5% to 10%, it's going to be gutted. And it's like, but because you lost three customers in a month, does that mean that you need to dial back your ad spend by 2/3 to like fix the ratio that some blog post said you should have? Like, it's not always the right move, because a lot of the time your lifetime value is going to fluctuate month over month faster than your decision-making should fluctuate, right? And so I think that like the context is important here. So the way that I like to do it, especially in the early days, is I just use annual contract value. So, you know, if I'm selling a $500 a month thing, 6K, right? 12 months. And so I just back in my acquisition cost, assuming that I'm going to keep every customer for a year. If I don't, I know I need to go solve that problem. And instead of looking at like acquisition cost to LTV as a ratio, the thing, and like if you take one thing from this little tirade, take this, the gold standard metric for bootstrapped B2B SaaS is CAC payback period, right? It's less about the ratio between acquisition cost and lifetime value, and more about how quickly can I get the cash back out of the machine that I put it into. And so, you know, I use my annual contract value as like that kind of standard, because I control that with my pricing. And then all I'm looking for is the units I've sold, how much it cost me, and how quickly can I recover the cash that I put in. If you get it to sub 30, neat, call me, I'll give you my credit card. And like that's the holy grail. But knowing how long your cash is going to be tied up, like you can grow too fast and run out of cash at the same time, because your CAC payback is too slow and all your money's tied up and you can't pay the bills, even though you're, you know, by the customer count, it looks like you're kicking ass. So yeah, that's how I look at it. I don't know if that was helpful or if I just went down a huge nerd rabbit hole, but that's how I think about it.
Yeah, it makes a ton of sense, man. I think it's going to be hard not to measure LTV because, well, it's fun to see how it evolves over time. Like, I like looking at it as a trend and using it to calibrate decisions on a quarterly or an annual basis. Like, let's look at, I think one of the things we've done, you know, more frequently, Well, more recently, Matt's looking at our last 4 months and saying, how is it trending there? And now we can, you know, 4 months is enough to have a trend and we can make some more confident decisions based on that. But yeah, as a one-off, difficult to make a ton of decisions based on LTV. I think you did a great job of explaining the pros and cons of using that and when it should be used and, you know, maybe when it's more of a vanity metric.
Rock and roll. Yeah, always track it, but it's not the first thing I reach for when I'm dialing up and down budget and stuff like that. Cool. Well, that was fun. This one is in Johnny's wheelhouse. This is our last question for the mailroom today from Kenny. I have hired AEs, account executives, AKA salespeople, closers, right? People who close deals for a living. I've hired account executives, but I've never had a consistent plan for their first 90 days. And I also have had inconsistent results. No surprise, his words. So like, what is, Johnny, like your high level 90 day plan for onboarding a salesperson? Like if you're onboarding someone, how are you thinking about this stuff, man?
Dude, 90 days is way too long for AE to be getting on plan. I'll tell you that much. Like, don't, first off, throw 90 days out the window. You're setting a bad expectation for your AE. I want them to think about how quickly or how much time I'm giving them to get on plan. And I want them to think, oh shit, I cannot mess around here. I need them to have a sense of urgency. So 90 days, you're taking all the wind out of the sails by saying, hey, we're gonna get you 90 days to get up to speed. So assuming you've hired someone that is qualified, someone that's experienced, look, the fewer AEs you've hired, the more you need to hire someone that has been on plan and has experience somewhere else. You do not hire a first-time sales rep into your organization for the first time because you don't have all the material and all the answers. You don't know what it looks like to get someone on plan. You need someone who has been to the promised land. Like, you need someone who has been successfully onboarded as an AE somewhere, stuck around for 18 months, been on plan, all that. And then they will be able to ask you questions that you didn't even know you needed to ask. So I like setting up any type of new hire in, there's two different ways you can train them. You can push to them all that you think they need to know, or you can give them a really big goal and expect for them to pull from you all that they need to know. And that, I like the latter much better. So give them, say, hey, you got 2 weeks to get on plan and I'm going to measure, you know, hey, we want you to start taking demos and you should close your first deal within the first 30 days. So you take your first demo 2 weeks in, 2 week sales cycle. We expect you to close your first one within 2 weeks. You'll have to customize this based on your, you know, how many deals you have, you know, how long it takes to actually close, but be aggressive. You want them to feel like I need to go pull from the organization all the context I need to have to go and have that first conversation. The second is you got to show them what winning looks like. You got to have a library of recorded winning calls that they can go in and they can study and they can start to pattern match. An AE that has been on plan before will be able to go watch some winning demos and very quickly start, they're just going to want to get on the phones. If you have to convince your AE to be getting on the phone, you got the wrong person. You can let them go. Like if I have to at all, I need to be telling them, hey, I got to make sure you don't make me look like an idiot. So I need you to watch some winning calls and show me you know how to talk the talk. But as soon as I feel like they're ready to go take some reps, I'm putting them on the call and they're going to very quickly iterate. If not, you probably got the wrong hire, but yeah, Matt, I think, you know, start off by throwing the 90 days out the window and give them a library of what winning looks like and let them go to work.
I love it, man. I just want to share one thing that you unlocked for me when you were explaining that, because I want to make sure that anyone who's listening to this catches it. If you're in this position, if you have not yet hired your first AE, the most important thing here that Johnny said is they've got to be able to understand what winning looks like. Sales is one of the few places where it makes sense to build the process before you have the team. So even if you're the one doing the calls, record your own calls. Even if there's no one else to review them, you can still review them. Even if you never review them, at least put them in a Google Drive folder that says, these ones got us money. So when you bring the AE in, they have something to pattern match against, right? Something to look at and learn from. So if you do nothing else, at least record the calls, the ones that closed, put them in a file somewhere, because at some day, sometime, some point, you're going to have somebody come in and they're going to need something to look at. So this is one of those times where a little bit of structure, even if it's just you doing all the calls, you're building that library so you can put the leverage into your team when they show up. You don't want to have to 90-day plans. It's because you're spending 70 days trying to get more wins to teach them what winning looks like in the first place, like capture it now. So I just think that's easy to breeze past if you're not thinking about it. So I want to call it out.
couple other hacks to get your AEs on plan faster: have them sit with your customer success team, like have them actually watch a customer use it. If they, yeah. The first account they sell, have them follow it all the way through to onboarding, because they'll speak with more conviction and just more experience when they've actually seen the product be used. So, I'd fill up that first 2 weeks. They're watching 4 or 5 demos per day. They're sitting with the customer success team. They're using the product. And then at most 2 weeks later, they're hitting the phones and either finding their own demos, or you're booking them on the demos, you're reviewing calls together. But we got to default to action. The only way we learn in sales is by doing. And we got to get as much activity in there as possible and just set a really big goal. It should be a hard goal to clear, and one that creates a sense of urgency and drive every day that AE is onboarding. If you make it too comfortable for them, we're leaving too much on the table. Yeah, Matt, anything else? I think, sometimes it's hard to see the forest from inside the in the trees, man. Is there anything else that you've seen us do? Like, we hire a lot of AEs, train a lot of AEs, take a lot of founders to getting out of founder-led sales. Like, anything else from your perspective?
Yeah, I think you kind of touched on it, but again, I just want to say it loudly. The why behind having them sit with your CS team: the first person who needs to be sold is your salesperson. The best salesperson in the world, if they're not confident that the thing they're selling is going to get the outcome for the customer, they will not be nearly as performant as they can be when they know that that customer is in the right place at the right time, buying the right thing for their problem. So the why behind having them sit with CS or product and look at usage, we're like, Johnny and I encapsulate this in what we call building a culture of winning, where like anytime a customer wins with your software, with your solution, whatever it is that they're selling, grab that win and put it in front of the salesperson, because it does two things. Number one, it gives them a success story to talk about in future sales conversations. Number two, it gets them, it increases their belief. It's reselling them, re-enrolling the salesperson into the mission of the company and being like, yo, this software actually works. It's freaking awesome. And you need this thing because I know, Jimmy over here, look at this success story. He's just like you, right? So just putting the wins, like completing the flywheel, right? You sell someone, they get the value, put that back in front of the salesperson. Because if they're not sold, you're never going to have the productivity that you'd otherwise have.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Which leads back to the last question we asked, is why I believe in customer success first. You got to go win for your customers, because it makes everything else easier. Like, very, very hard for your sales team to believe and to essentially evangelize your product if you're not winning. And if you are winning, we got to make sure we are indoctrinating our sales team to the company mission and why this problem needs to be solved in our customers' organizations. We can do that really well. There's an energy that's felt on the sales call. It's not just about what they say, it's how they're saying it and the enthusiasm that they're communicating with that really, increases their close rates and gets them on plan.
I love it. Thanks, Johnny and Kenny. That was an awesome question, man. So appreciate it. Cool. 4 for 4 on the SaaS Academy mailroom. Dude, that was a lot of fun. Like it always is. I think we got to keep doing these.
Yeah, same. I agree. Hey guys, if you have a question you want us to answer, these are not just, Matt and I would love to answer some of our community questions from, outside of SaaS Academy or Growth Accelerator. If you got them, email us at podcast@saasacademy.com and we'd love to jam on it.
Love it. All right, man. Talk soon.